So I just wanted to welcome everybody to today's Health Economics Seminar, Cyber Seminar. Today we have two presenters, Christine Palchi and Donna Zellman, are going to be talking about the IMPACT project, which is a randomized controlled trial of an intensive management for patient-aligned care teams for these very high expensive patients. And Donna is a career development awardee and clinician here in Palo Alto, and Christine is one of the health economists here in Palo Alto. So very happy to have them.
Thank you, Todd. I'm Christine Palchi. As Todd mentioned, I'm a health economist at the Health Economics Resource Center, and I'll let Donna just briefly introduce herself.
I'm Donna Zellman. I'm a general internist and health services researcher here at VA Palo Alto.
Okay. And Donna and I today will be presenting results. Actually, we'll first be describing this intensive management patient-aligned care team that was piloted here in Palo Alto, and then we'll also discuss results from the evaluation. And Donna and I are actually going to tag team the presentation to keep things lively. I'll be discussing elements of the study design and results from the evaluation. And Donna?
And I'm going to be first describing what we've learned about some of the high-cost patients in the VA nationally and describing the program as it developed and how we developed it. And then talking a little bit about the implementation challenges and some now ongoing work nationally in this area.
But before we begin, we thought it would actually be very helpful just to get a sense of why people are here today, what you're most interested in. We'll ask Heidi to help us put up this poll. So what is your primary reason for joining today's discussion? You can select the first option, I would like to develop a clinical program for high-risk VA patients. The second, I'm interested in studying interventions for high-risk VA patients. C, the third, I'm in a leadership position and I want to learn about effective interventions for high-risk VA patients. And D, the last one, I just find the topic interesting.
And unfortunately, I have a character limit there, so the responses on the screen are a little bit shorter than what you just heard, but responses are coming in nicely. We'll give you all just a few more seconds before I close the poll question out and go through the results. And we'll close that out here. And we are seeing 7% saying developing a clinical program for high-risk VA patients. 41% are interested in studying interventions for high-risk VA patients, 11% in a leadership position and want to learn about interventions, and 41% just find the topic interesting. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, great. So just to start off, it's been shown across a range of healthcare settings and populations that 5% of patients account for approximately 50% of healthcare costs. So this slide shows the distribution of healthcare spending for the VA, and similar patterns have been observed within the general population and within Medicaid populations, and in a slightly attenuated fashion within the Medicare population. As many as 40% of patients in the top 5% will persist in this most costly bracket the following year that's been shown outside the VA. And as a result, there's a lot of interest in identifying effective interventions to optimize and streamline care for these patients. So a group of us here at Palo Alto and HERC had an opportunity to explore some of the characteristics and healthcare utilization patterns of the most costly 5% of VA patients in fiscal year 2010. Here you can see the breakdown of costs for these patients. The mean total cost for this cohort was $73,000, the median was $53,000. And you can see that in aggregate, approximately half of the costs were generated in the inpatient setting in orange, but a close to a third were generated in the outpatient setting in blue. Half of these patients had one or two hospitalizations in the year that we looked at, and 16% had three or more hospitalizations, 37% had one or two ER visits, and 29% had three or more ER visits. And when we compare the VA's most costly patients on the left to the remaining population on the right, you can see that a disproportionate number are between the ages of 45 and 64, that mortality was high during the year of investigation, 14% were homeless, suggesting that many of these patients have important needs outside of their immediate medical care, and a lower proportion of patients in the top 5% are married, so many of these patients likely have needs for social support as well. Here you can see the most common chronic conditions and mental health conditions among the top 5% on the left compared to the remaining population on the right. So you see high rates of common conditions such as hypertension and diabetes, and disproportionately high rates of costly conditions such as chronic renal failure and heart failure. And then 47% of the patients have a mental health condition, and again, we see disproportionate rates of complex and costly conditions such as substance abuse and schizophrenia. When we look at multimorbidity or the presence of multiple chronic conditions, you can see here that 76% of the patients in the top 5% have three or more chronic conditions, 42% have five or more chronic conditions. And then when we group those conditions into body systems, you can see that 65% have conditions affecting three or more different body systems. So, for example, cardiovascular disease, as well as a pulmonary disease and a mental health condition. And 19% of the patients have conditions affecting five or more body systems. So just to summarize some of these early findings, this was an exploratory study of patients who were high cost for a single year within the VA system. Again, we see frequent hospitalizations and ER visits, a high volume of outpatient primary and specialty care, high rates of multimorbidity, with 76% of the patients having three or more chronic conditions, high rates of mental health conditions and homelessness, and likely many of these patients also have insufficient social support. So that was a quick overview of some of the characteristics of the VA's high-cost patients. And so we then turned to thinking about interventions, and at this point the VA had rolled out this extensive patient-centered medical home program where every patient in the VA system has access to a PAC team or patient-aligned care team for their primary care. So our question was, how do we build on the existing VA primary care system to better meet the needs of these highly complex and high-cost patients? So before continuing, we have a second poll now that will help us guide the next part of the discussion. So our question now is, are you familiar with the structure of PAC teams in the VA? Yes or no?
And we'll give everyone just a few moments to respond there, and we'll close the poll question out and go through the results. Just waiting for the responses to slow down. And it looks like we're good there. So we're seeing 58% saying yes and 42% saying no. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. So for those of you who are not familiar with the PAC team, every patient in the VA has access to a teamlet of providers. So this includes a physician or nurse practitioner, that's their primary care provider, a care manager, a nurse, and then a clinical associate, typically an LPN or MA, and then there's a clerk. So each patient and caregiver has access to that team, and all of the teams have a hub of other team members who can provide additional services, clinical pharmacy services, social work, nutrition, case managers, behavioral health, and so forth. So this means that all VA patients already have access to a fairly comprehensive primary care system. So again, the question in thinking about interventions is, how do we build on the existing infrastructure to better meet the needs of these high-risk patients? So that led to this idea of IMPACT, or Intensive Management PACT. And so to give you some background about this idea of intensive primary care, many of you may recognize this picture. It's from a 2011 New Yorker article by Atul Gawande entitled The Hotspotters. The article profiled the Camden Coalition Clinic in Camden, New Jersey. The clinic, founded by Dr. Jeffrey Brenner, was one of the first to innovate around this idea of intensive primary care. So the idea of these programs is to identify individuals with the highest rates of healthcare utilization. So these are often patients who have very frequent ER visits and hospital readmissions, and then provide those patients with exceptional individualized care. So, for example, they offer frequent in-person and often after-hours contact. They help coordinate primary and specialty care. They provide support to patients during transitions from hospital to home. They facilitate access to social and community resources. For some patients, this may involve assisting with housing and other critical needs. And through this type of effort, the Camden Coalition was able to dramatically cut ER visits and hospital stays among a small group of extremely high-cost patients. And there are a number of other examples of programs that have focused on complex high-risk patients in a variety of settings, especially in the geriatrics literature, and also in both private and safety net settings outside the VA. And while there have been few randomized controlled trials of these programs, the observational studies suggest that this type of model may hold promise for improving care while reducing costs for these patients.
Donna, quick question for you.
Sure.
Let's come in. For the PAC teams, and possibly you can speak about this more broadly, there's a question about the ratio of patients to teams. So you said 1,200 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, how is that defined for VA, and is that consistent across other providers?
So the teamlet, again, I think it may vary a little bit by facility, but the teamlet typically has approximately 1,000, 1,200 patients that they're responsible for. And are you asking about the how many care managers, for example, would take care of those patients?
How is the number 1,200 approximately identified? Is that just from history, or?
I'm actually not sure.
Okay.
Yes.
And is that panel size typical for non-VA as well when you get into these other programs, or is that very highly variable?
These are panel sizes for the VA patient-centered medical home. I think it may vary quite a bit outside the VA.
Okay.
And for these intensive management programs, the panel is typically much, much smaller. It may be anywhere from, you know, maybe 100 patients per health, you know, case manager, health coach, depending on who the point of contact is, and, you know, typically just a couple of hundred for the entire program. But, again, I think there's quite a range depending on the environment. The other important piece here is that these programs are very heterogeneous in terms of the patients that they're serving. So some of the programs, the King County program, for example, is serving high-risk Medicaid patients who typically have substantial mental health issues, substance use, and other programs are focusing on, you know, the TBGH programs are focusing more typically on employed patients. And so the needs of the patients vary quite a lot, but what the programs all have in common is that they're taking the highest kind of risk patients within any given setting, and they're trying to provide services for those patients.
Okay, and we actually just had two other people who chimed in as listeners. One person said the PACT handbook outlines the panel sizes, and then another person says the panel sizes are quite typical for managed care plans in this arena.
Oh, great. So. Great, thank you. Okay. So approximately 2 years ago, the Palo Alto VA decided to implement this intensive management program. And the framework for the program was adapted from Ed Wagner's chronic care model. So the goal of IMPACT is to transform the care in each of the domains at the top. So, for example, by engaging patients in community resources, providing them with self-management support, and redesigning care, for example, through enhanced access, after-hours services, and case management. And ultimately, the goal is to empower patients and their caregivers with necessary resources and to facilitate productive interactions between the patients and this multidisciplinary team. And so then the outcomes at the bottom are the outcomes that we're looking at in the evaluation. So our goal was to assess whether this program improved utilization patterns, decreasing use of the ER and hospital admissions, and improved patient-centered outcomes. So before implementing the program, we had an opportunity to interview some of the high-cost patients at the Palo Alto facility to learn about the challenges that they face. And so we heard things like, for someone who has many conditions and a condition that could kill me at any time, I should be monitored all the time. I never know when I'm going to have to go to the ER. I can't finish programs, and I don't know why. I wish someone would help me navigate the system. I don't know what resources or programs are available to me. And the other themes that came up were continuity and communication challenges. So patients talked about lack of provider continuity, having a lot of different specialists, difficulties coordinating multiple providers. Many of the patients had needs for social support and social services, and many of the patients expressed interest in having after-hours contact and access, for example, because of unstable health conditions or anxiety or isolation that generated, you know, needs to talk to providers in the evenings and on weekends. And so taking some of what we've learned from the kind of quantitative work we did early on with the high-cost patients and then this qualitative, the interviews with the patients, we developed a program that we felt was a good fit for the VA. This slide shows the core elements of the IMPACT program and the IMPACT team members on the right, including Jonathan Shaw, our physician, Katie Holloway, our recreation therapist, Terry Rogers on the bottom left, who's the coordinator for the program, Miriam Trigueros, who's a social worker, and then Deborah Hummel, who's the nurse practitioner. A really fantastic group that I want to make sure to acknowledge. They're really the heart of this program. So it's a multidisciplinary team. Again, their goal is really to provide this exceptional individualized care that's based on the patient's goals and challenges and needs. They do a comprehensive intake and provide a frequent in-person contact and telephone contact with the patients. They offer intensive case management for chronic conditions. They help coordinate the primary and specialty care, and this often involves going to specialists with the patients to help kind of navigate the care that they need and potentially help de-escalate care that they don't need. They're able to rapidly respond if a patient's health deteriorates. They provide support during transitions from hospital to home. They're able to go visit the patients in the hospital to help work with the inpatient team around the discharge plan and then follow up with the patient after discharge. And then another key part of this program is they provide access to social and community resources. This involves getting patients engaged in community programs, Tai Chi classes and cooking classes and their community pools, which kind of has helped with patients' quality of life and also has helped engage them in the program and build their trust in the VA. In terms of our evaluation, because this was a pilot, we wanted to study its effectiveness but also understand the implementation process and barriers. So we conducted what's called a type 1 hybrid trial, which allowed us to test the clinical intervention while also gathering information about delivery and implementation. And I want to mention that this evaluation involved a very close partnership with facility leadership at the VA Palo Alto. A critical piece of this was that IMPACT was implemented as a quality improvement pilot. So the facility wanted to find out whether an intensive management team would be a valuable addition to PACT at Palo Alto. But because they really wanted to understand the effects of the program, they agreed to offer it to a random sample of patients initially. That allowed us as health services researchers to work with them to evaluate it in a pretty rigorous way. So we ended up with 150 patients who were randomly assigned to participate in IMPACT during the pilot period, and then the remaining eligible patients continued to receive usual care through PACT. So I'm now going to turn it over to Christine. She's going to describe our methods in a bit more detail.
Thanks, Donna. I would like to highlight, so Donna had mentioned that patients were randomly selected for the IMPACT program. I wanted to highlight that the fact that patients were randomly selected for the program really facilitated our evaluation. It made our jobs as researchers much easier in terms of establishing the causal effect of this program. And Donna will discuss in a little bit some results that support that there was a true randomization or successful randomization. But in this evaluation, we wanted to estimate the effect of the program on healthcare costs and utilization. And there we use data from the DSS office. So our question was, what effect did IMPACT have on healthcare costs and utilization? In our primary analysis, we estimated the intention to treat effect within a difference in differences framework, where we compared pre- and post-treatment outcomes across the control and treatment groups. And I'll talk a little bit more about this. But here, we estimate the average treatment effect in the population that was eligible for treatment. But because not everyone who was eligible for treatment actually received treatment, so not everyone who was randomly selected for IMPACT actually enrolled and received IMPACT services, and because we believe that those who engaged with the program may differ from those who did not engage from the program in ways that might affect their costs or utilization, we use instrumental variables analysis. With randomization as an instrument, and we believe randomization here is a valid instrument because, one, it is relevant. Randomization, whether or not you're randomized to receive IMPACT, determines or affects whether or not you actually engage in IMPACT. And we find that most patients who were randomized to receive IMPACT actually enrolled. And second, randomization, we believe, is exogenous, so it's unrelated to other factors that might affect a person's costs or utilization. And particularly, they're unrelated to these factors that might be correlated with whether or not someone actually chooses to engage in the program. And there, in the instrumental variables analysis, we estimate the effect of treatment on the treated. That is, we estimate the effect of the program among those who actually engaged in the program. And here we define engagement or treatment to be having completed intake and having at least 3 encounters. And to evaluate whether the program effects differed across different groups of patients, we also stratified analyses by key characteristics. And here we looked at patients who were over and under the age of 65, patients who had a mental health condition, patients who had chronic heart failure, diabetes, COPD, and those who had a recent hospitalization. So I'll share more about the results from our evaluation in a little bit after Donna shares more about the program and some initial lessons learned.
Okay, great. So this is the timeline for the intervention and evaluation. Starting at the left, we identified patients using data from a 9-month period. We selected patients who were either high cost or at high risk for hospitalization. It then took a couple of months to hire the staff and refine the program. So we had a pre-period of 16 months. The red line, February 2013, indicates when we started enrolling new patients, and it then took about 9 months to enroll all of the patients who ultimately participated. So we reached what we call the steady state at the end of August 2013, and then today we're going to present analyses for the first full 17 months of the intervention period, so comparing that post-period to the pre-period. And here you can see how patients were selected for the pilot. So we started again with about the 5,000 patients who were either in the top 5% for the facility based on their total costs of VA care or were in the top 5% based on their risk of hospitalization over the next year. We used for this, to identify their risk, we used the Care Assessment Needs Score, which is a score that's been developed within the VA and can, helps predict patients who are likely to be hospitalized. In our case, we used their risk of hospitalization over the following year. We excluded patients who died before the before we started the program, and also excluded patients who were already enrolled in intensive management type of program, either through home-based primary care, through palliative care, or through mental health intensive case management, MICM. We also excluded patients who had a length of stay of over 50% of the baseline period. This was because we really wanted to focus on patients who were primarily in the outpatient setting. So we then ended up with about 4,000 patients who met our inclusion criteria. We funneled that down to patients who had one of 14 providers who were part of the pilot intervention. These PAC providers were either physicians or nurse practitioners, and they were all attendings, not residents. We excluded patients then who had low costs or were at low risk and ended up with our 583 patients and again and randomly identified 150 to invite to participate for the pilot.
Donna?
Yes.
This is Doug. Can you go back one slide? We have a question from the audience, which is that the 150 assigned to IMPACT is considerably smaller than the 1,200 we talked about earlier. Is that because of it being a research study, or is that just because in the clinic it's just much harder to manage this group of high-use patients?
Right. So the PACT panel is very heterogeneous in terms of needs. So there are a lot of patients who are receiving care through PACT who have very few needs throughout the year. Some of them, for example, may get a lot of their primary care outside of the VA system and only come to the VA to get medications. Others may just have, you know, hypertension or, you know, one condition that needs some following. The idea of IMPACT is to take the very highest risk patients from the PAC teams and consolidate them and give them these additional resources. Those patients are still continuing to get some care from their PACs, and they can still work with their primary care provider, but IMPACT kind of provides this layer of additional services on top of what they're getting through PACT. And it's an intentionally small panel because these are patients. Some of these patients may need daily or weekly contact. They might require home visits. They're in and out of the hospital a lot. And so we anticipate that they're, that the team will only be able to manage a small number. It's still not clear what the right number is for these programs, and I'm going to, towards the end of the presentation today, I'm going to talk about some other work that's being done in the VA nationally that's kind of trying to figure out what's the right balance in terms of numbers of patients and how many of those patients need the very intensive management versus just the more keeping an eye on them and intervening when necessary. But that's part of where we arrived at the number. We also, arriving at the 150, we also extrapolated from what we were learning outside of the VA in terms of kind of the appropriate size for these really intensive management programs.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so this is just to show that our randomization worked for key variables, including age, sex, urban versus rural location, presence of non-VA insurance, indication of any homelessness during the 9-month baseline period, number of chronic conditions, and frequency of hospitalization and ER use during the baseline period. And here you can see rates of chronic conditions, and again, they were well balanced across the two groups. We looked at 40 conditions in total, and you can see that there were slightly more patients in impact with coronary artery disease, slightly more patients in the control group with cancer, but for the most part, the two groups were well balanced. Okay, so now we're going to turn to some of our findings from the evaluation. So what did we learn? First, approximately two-thirds of the patients who we invited to participate actually engaged in the program. As Christine mentioned, we defined engagement as completing the impact and at least three additional encounters with the team. And here you can see that there were some important differences between the patients who engaged and those who did not. So patients who engaged were older, were more likely to live in an urban location, were more likely to have non-VA insurance. Most of this was accounted for by Medicare and reflects the older patients in the engaged groups. But the other characteristics on the list were similar across the two groups. And then when we look at chronic conditions among the engaged and non-engaged patients, we can see differences in the number of patients with liver disease or hepatitis C, certain mental health conditions. So patients who engaged had lower rates of drug use, alcohol use, and schizophrenia. But all of the other conditions, again, were similar across the two groups. Our next finding was that among the patients who engaged in the program, most felt that it was extremely valuable. So we conducted pre-post surveys with the impact patients, only with the impact patients, not with the control patients receiving usual care. We had about a 60% response rate to the follow-up survey among the program participants. And 93% of these respondents said that they would recommend impact to others. We heard things like, the impact program helps me keep track of my health, need my health and well-being and medical care. Knowing that someone has your back means a lot. I don't have to go to the ER for minor things. Having a liaison between myself, my doctor, hospital, and pharmacy is so very crucial to me, and impact fits the bill. Not to sound like a TV commercial, but one call does it all. And you can see that there were very high satisfaction rates with the medical care, social work, recreation therapy, and community services and after-hours care that patients were receiving through the program. So we also saw that among the survey respondents, there was an increase in general satisfaction with the VA overall, so that the percentage of patients who agreed that care at Palo Alto VA is just about perfect increased, and there was also an increase in communication satisfaction, so the percentage of patients who disagreed that doctors at Palo Alto VA often ignore what I tell them also increased. Okay, I'm now going to turn it back to Christine to present some additional findings.
Thanks, Anna. So the third thing we learned was that there was no program effect on mortality. And here we present results graphically. And what we do here is plot on the y-axis, we plot the percentage of patients alive in each group at each month. And on the x-axis, we plot months since the start of the impact program. And the blue line is the percent of patients in the usual care, the delayed control group, who are alive at each month. And the red line plots the percent of patients in the impact group who are alive in each month. And you can see here that there is no discernible difference in mortality across the two groups. These two lines basically track each other. So we see no effect here, and this is the same when we run regressions, the results are the same. We find no difference in mortality between the two groups. The fourth thing we find was that the intervention was cost neutral. And here we start off with graphical results again, although I'll discuss more specific results and numbers in just a little bit. Here what we do on the y-axis, we plot average VA Palo Alto monthly costs, and this is inclusive of impact costs. And on the x-axis, we plot months during the study period. The dark vertical red line, February 2013, marks the beginning of impact. And the thin red line, which corresponds to August, the end of August or September 2013, marks when the last patient who participated was enrolled in the program. So after that, everyone who participated was enrolled. The blue line plots, the dotted blue line, plots the average VA Palo Alto monthly cost among the usual care, the control group, each month. And the red line plots the average VA Palo Alto monthly cost at each month for the impact or the treatment group. And we can see here, one really interesting and important thing to see here is that for both groups, average costs declined over time. So in general, patients don't have high costs persist indefinitely. It's very difficult for a patient to basically sustain high costs over an extended period of time. And the fact that both groups see this decline in costs actually highlights the importance of the control group in our analysis and the value of the difference in differences framework. So without the control group, if we were to only look at the red line, at the treatment group, we would see that average post-monthly costs are actually lower than the pre-monthly costs. So there is a reduction in costs across the pre- and control post-time periods. And we might attribute that cost reduction to the program. But we see here that costs in the impact group did not decline any more than they did in the control group. At the same time, the program also did not appear to increase costs in the impact group, and that's despite the fact that impact was providing intensive care to these patients. Another way to look at this, which highlights the difference in differences result, is in this following figure. Here, what we do is each of the bars here corresponds to the average monthly cost in each of the pre- or post-control time periods for the control and treatment group. So we'll start with the dark blue bar on the left. This bar here shows us that the average monthly cost in the pre-impact period for the usual care of the control group was about $5,800 per month. In the post period, the average cost declined to about $4,600. So there was a decline of about $1,200 between the pre and the post periods for the usual care patients. The dark orange bar shows us that the average monthly cost in the pre-impact period for the impact patients, so this is our treatment group, was about $1,100 in the pre-intervention period. In the post-intervention period, average monthly costs were about $4,800. So in the treatment group, there was a change of about $1,290. So the assumption here in difference in differences is that in the absence of treatment, what would have happened in the treatment group is what did happen in the control group. So in the absence of treatment, we would expect costs in the treatment group to decline by $1,200. Instead, we observed a decline of $1,290, which gives us, if we take the difference of those two, we get the difference in differences, which is about $86. So we can see here that costs declined by $86 more in the impact group than it did in the control group. And we can attribute, and I should mention that these are just raw costs. So these numbers are just not from our regressions. They're raw costs. And Although we decided to show this for simplicity, we will talk a little bit more. I'll show our actual regression results in a little bit, and they're actually very similar to these numbers. But we see here that the decline of cost of $86 is very small. And we'll see later in regression results that the estimated program effect on cost is both small and statistically insignificant.
We have a couple questions, and I want to make sure that I'm interpreting it correctly, Christine. One is, because you're looking at monthly costs, if an inpatient stay crosses the month, you just allocate the costs proportionate to length of stay in the month, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And does the cost that you're looking at here include the program cost of developing this impact program and running the impact program?
Yes, it includes the cost of any care received through the impact program.
So the additional staff that you hired and so forth is all built into this?
We did discuss how we should include impact costs, and one option was to include the cost of the staff who were hired for this. Another option was to include the cost of the encounters or the services that were provided through impact. And here what we did was we included the cost of the encounters, the impact encounters.
Okay, thank you.
So our fifth finding was that the intervention could potentially have an effect for certain subgroups of patients. So we found that on average, or for the entire group of treated patients, the estimated program effect was quite small, and it was statistically insignificant. But for some patients, the program might be beneficial. And we see here, so these are regression results. And here I'm going to start off with results for all patients. And here we report the intention to treat, the difference in differences estimates. So here we see that impact was led to a $100 decrease in monthly cost. But that, as a fact, was not statistically insignificant. We see that there's a much larger standard error. I mentioned earlier that because not all patients who were offered the program actually participated in the program, we wanted to also evaluate the effect of the program on among patients who actually did participate. And in our last two columns here are results from the instrumental variables analysis. We see here that impact reduced costs by about $130 per month among patients who actually did participate in the program. Again, here the result, the effect is small and statistically insignificant. But here we look at results for patients. We focus on the group of patients with heart failure, diabetes, or COPD. And we find here that the estimated program effect is actually a reduction of about $750 per month among the entire group of patients with those conditions. That number is larger, but it's also statistically insignificant. Among patients who actually received treatment, the estimated program effect was a reduction of about $1,100 per month. Again, we did not have precision to reject the null hypothesis that the program had zero effect on cost. We also look at patients who have a mental health condition and do not have a mental health condition. Again, the results are qualitatively similar to what we found for all patients. Now we focus on patients who are under the age of 65 and compare them to, as opposed to over the age of 65. And the interesting thing here, so the results here, again, not statistically significant, but qualitatively the results are actually quite interesting. So among patients who are under the age of 65, it looks like impact might have reduced their costs. But for patients who are over the age of 65, it looks like impact actually increased their costs. And we think this is because patients who are over the age of 65 might be shifting their care from Medicare to the VA. And we also focus on patients who are high cost at baseline compared to high risk or having a high risk of hospitalization at baseline. Here we find that the program did not seem to have an effect on their costs. We also looked at patients who were hospitalized in the 6 months prior to enrollment. Again, similar results. And finally, we look at patients who are at high risk of hospitalization and who are hospitalized in the pre-period. We find somewhat larger effects, but also statistically insignificant. But these results suggest, although we don't have much precision, they suggest that the program might be beneficial to certain subgroups of patients. And with that, I'll hand it back to Donna.
Okay, so I'm actually going to move pretty quickly through this next piece because I just want to make sure we have enough time for questions. But as I mentioned, this was a hybrid trial. We wanted to learn about implementation, the process of implementation and barriers and facilitators, as well as about the effectiveness. So we conducted interviews. Jessica Breland, one of our postdocs, led these interviews with all of the IMPACT team members, facility leadership, and some of the providers who interacted with IMPACT using the CFIR Consolidated Framework for Implementation Research framework to develop interview questions. And the goal, again, was to identify barriers and facilitators to implementation and to understand the strengths of the program and also opportunities for improvement. Some of the facilitators that we heard about again and again were the proactive and creative approach of the IMPACT staff. We heard a lot about how the team really would, you know, jump in when providers asked for support and how they had a lot of creative ideas to try to help patients who were in and out of the ER. The adaptability of IMPACT design, so the program really evolved over time as the team understood more and more about the patient's needs and also about the resources at the VA. And so the fact that it was adaptable was very helpful. And then in terms of the local environment, there people spoke a lot about how engaged the leadership was with this program and how helpful that was, and also how there's sort of a culture of innovation at the VA Palo Alto, which helps kind of get buy-in from all of the different stakeholders in trying something new like this. Barriers included the complexity of this patient population. These patients' needs are very heterogeneous in terms of their conditions and their social needs. And so that one staff member said IMPACT at its core is trying to address 100 or 200 patients' individual needs and goals. I think mental health, the patients who had serious mental illnesses were a particularly challenging group for the team to engage. And they didn't have a mental health provider on the original team. They worked very closely with the mental health care services at the Palo Alto VA, but I think they felt it would have been helpful to have someone with that expertise. It was difficult to reach the rotating hospital staff and to collaborate with them. And they also noted that because this was a pilot and we were evaluating it, there was quite a lot of pressure, and they were, you know, we didn't know how long the program would be in existence, and so that created some challenges for them in moving quickly and not knowing, having some uncertainty about the future. Okay, so finally, I think one of the most important lessons we learned from this project was that this rigorous evaluation of this type of model is really important. As we've said, as Christine said, a lot of these programs have been looked at just with pre-post results, and it's potentially that could potentially be misleading because of this regression to mean effect that can occur in patients who are very high cost at baseline. And we also found, as Christine mentioned in our subgroup analyses, that there are potential groups of patients who may be benefiting from this program. So we think that there's still a lot to learn about patient selection for these programs and the appropriate mix of services, some of the staffing issues that came up in our earlier conversation. So we're fortunate in that the VA has invested in a national demonstration project to look at other types of models of intensive management for high-risk patients. Here, the programs in yellow, San Francisco, Milwaukee, Cleveland, Salisbury, and Atlanta are all in the process of enrolling patients now. Palo Alto and Los Angeles are collaborating on a national evaluation of all five programs. The VA has adopted the kind of hybrid or the partnered research approach that we use for IMPACT, which is wonderful, so that all five of these programs are enrolling random samples of patients, which will allow us to do a really rigorous evaluation of all five programs in a central way. So that's exciting, and we hope to learn more over the next couple of years. And I just wanted to mention that each of the programs is really bringing unique elements to the table. And so, for example, San Francisco is focusing on older adults,
Milwaukee is focusing a lot on the transitions from hospital to home. They're enrolling patients during a hospitalization. Cleveland is engaging military medics and really emphasizing peer support and trying to support the PAC teams to prevent provider burnout. Salisbury is working a lot on, Salisbury is unique because the PIM program is actually going to assume total care for the patients, whereas all the other programs layer on top of the PAC program. And then Atlanta has a lot of rural patients, and so is involving a lot of telehealth and is emphasizing patient activation. So we're hoping to learn a lot from each of these. So with that, and just to, again, say that we have a plan now for this national evaluation, and these are some of the outcomes that we're going to be looking at. But I want to make sure we have time for questions. So I want to leave this slide up just to thank the many, many individuals who have been involved. On the left, those are the individuals who were involved in the high utilizer analyses that we presented at the very beginning. The impact evaluation team, the impact clinical team, and the Palo Alto leadership, and the many people who've helped advise us in that work. And then all of the PIM sites and the National Evaluation Center individuals below who are helping us learn in this next iteration. And then we've listed the many groups that have helped support this work. And we are happy to take your questions. Thank you.
We are getting some questions in, so this is great. One of the questions is just a little bit of clarification. You mentioned early on that 150 people were randomized to the IMPACT program, but the question says it looks like 140 were used in analysis. Is there, just to clarify the numbers there?
Yeah, so when we ultimately got all of the data together for the analysis, we found that there were some patients who had either died or moved away before the program started, and so we limited the evaluation to those patients, and that's why the numbers just dropped a little bit.
Okay. So the next question I have here is a little bit of a long one, so I'll see if I can read it, maybe break it down. Beyond costs, have you evaluated patient outcomes to see if patients were more treatment compliant?
That's a great question. So I think there's still a lot to learn around patient outcomes. We were somewhat limited in looking at patient outcomes because this was a quality improvement. The IMPACT program was quality improvement, and as such, we felt that we could only survey and interact with the patients who were in the IMPACT program. We didn't contact the patients in usual care. So we therefore couldn't look at differences between the two groups. What we did look at was, you know, the patient satisfaction and some other things around patient experience, like their activation level. We are now doing some analyses, what we can, with EHR data to try to understand more about patients' care and kind of the quality of their care and their experience with the program. So, for example, we're looking among the patients who died at whether they got hospice, whether they were referred to hospice, how long they were in hospice, and whether they died at home or in the inpatient setting. We're looking at how much continuity patients had with their providers, whether the amount of kind of balance of inpatient to telephone care that patients had, whether they were contacted closely after discharge, within 2 days after discharge. So some of those things, some of those measures we're adapting from the PAC national evaluation to try to understand whether patients, kind of the quality metrics of their care might have changed. In terms of adherence, I think it's a really terrific and important question. It's a challenging one just because, again, the patients are so heterogeneous in terms of their needs and that we didn't end up looking at any disease-specific measures. In principle, it would be possible to look at their adherence with all of their medications, but it's sort of beyond the scope of what we could do with this analysis, but I think it's a really important kind of intermediate measure that it would be great to look at some point.
Sounds great. Also, you mentioned that there are homeless. What role do you think the specialized PAC teams can have in addressing social determinants of health or to tailor care and address needs that can play in this process? And this person gives an example. For example, homeless PACs are incorporating many of these features, including reducing panel sizes, multidisciplinary providers, walk-in visits. Where do special population PACs fit into this sort of analysis?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think, in particular, the homeless patients were a group that the team had a lot of difficulty engaging, and it's possible that there are going to be certain subgroups of these high-risk patients that really need a very specialized program, and homeless patients may be one of them. Patients with serious mental illness or substance use may be another one. And so I think that's where kind of understanding who are the patients who are most likely to engage in these programs and benefit from these programs is very important. I think that the specialized PACs may be particularly good for patients whose needs fall very much in one domain, and this type of intensive management program may be a better fit for the patients who have multiple chronic conditions and need a lot of coordinated care across a lot of different specialties. In terms of the social determinants of health, I do think that, in general, that there is an opportunity for these types of programs to help with those issues because for the PIM programs, many of them are doing home visits and are able to kind of help engage the patients within their community and build social support for the patients and things like that. So there may be ways of also harnessing a lot of existing VA resources, but having the time to really take advantage of those resources and get them to the patients.
Okay, but the homelessness issue and the social determinants, the more you sort of focus on very specific populations, though, also reduces not necessarily your generalizability, but the number of sites at which this could be used and perhaps increase your costs of finding those patients. So if you wanted to do an impact project for homeless patients with blonde hair, blue eyes, who are 46 years old and a birthday in April, and I'm being totally facetious there, but it's you see my point. It's sometimes very hard to develop a program so specific to that.
That's right. I mean, we were hoping with this to try to avoid creating another silo of care in the VA, because sometimes there are these programs, there are so many different programs, and they're not And like you say, they might be very specific in the population that they're helping. But I do think that this is not based on evidence. It's sort of based on just having done a lot of work now in this area, that there are going to be populations for whom those types of programs are probably a good fit, and then there are going to be a lot of other patients who are going to have more, you know, diverse needs. They're going to be better suited for a more general program like this one.
Sounds great. The next question I have is for Christine. And I know that the difference model largely follows the intent to treat analysis. Did you do a lot of work with covariates that you were adding to this in a sort of multivariate difference model, or did that not matter?
That's a great question, Todd. So the thing that we had working on our side was that we had randomization of patients, and we saw that patients were actually pretty well balanced on observable characteristics. And because that was true, when we did control for these observable characteristics, like homelessness, age, gender, chronic conditions, we found that it did not have much of an impact on our estimates of the program effect as we would expect. But that said, we did control for person fixed effects, to account for any unobserved differences that do not change over time across patients. And again, there we did not find that including the fixed effects had much of an impact on our estimates, but for kind of comprehensiveness, that was the specification we chose.
Right, and then you went a step farther, which was to use the instrumental variables to recognize that there were certain people who were engaged and not engaged in trying to figure out what is it, the engagement, and maybe, but that also did not pan out, at least on a quantitative sense. You did point out some qualitative differences that you'll need some bigger sample sizes.
Yes. So I should just highlight that the intent to treat effect and the treatment on the treated effect are actually different. So the intent to treat effect is the average effect of treatment among all patients who were eligible or who were offered the program, and the treatment on the treated effect is just the treatment effect among patients who received treatment. So these were the patients who engaged. So there's a subtle difference there, but the two estimates should be capturing different things. But like you mentioned, we didn't find too many large differences between the two estimates.
Sounds great. There's another question: is did you find that hospitalizations, emergency department visits, time not living at home were reduced in impact patients compared to usual care?
Yeah, so really important question, and I think it just didn't make the final slide deck, but no, there was no difference in both groups had a decrease in hospitalizations and in ER visits, and they were virtually identical, so we didn't see any difference in the two groups. There were, you know, some potential changes in length of stay for certain subgroups. Again, none of them were significant, but there, you know, there was a possibility that, for example, the patients with the chronic conditions, the heart failure, COPD, and diabetes had a decrease in their length of stay in long-term care. I also just want to mention that the reason that we focused on those three conditions was that when talking to the team, they felt that those were the three chronic conditions where they had the greatest effect. And so that's why we selected those kind of a priori as a subgroup.
Sounds great. And did you assess any other outcomes, let's say patient-centered outcomes, besides satisfaction?
We looked at, again, just in the impact group, we looked at changes in functional status, changes in symptom burden, and changes in patient activation. And I think if somebody's interested in those, maybe they can communicate with me afterwards. At the top of my head, the functional status and symptom burden in general got worse over the period of time that we looked at, and we attribute this to the fact that the patients are very sick, and many of them are going to be getting sicker. Unfortunately, we can't look at the control group to know whether there was maybe a difference in the rate at which they were, you know, having those changes between the two groups. Patient activation, we had some patients who had improved activation over the time period, but it was, I think, maybe just barely clinically significant.
Great. And we have one last question, and it's probably a great question to end on, which is, given the results of this pilot did not produce cost savings, do you feel this program can be supported by the VA on a larger scale, and will the additional study need to demonstrate cost savings? Will we need to demonstrate cost savings for this to work? I guess another way of phrasing that.
That's a, you know, very important question. I think the second part of the question I'll have to defer to people who have much greater power and clout than I do. But I do think that while the findings here were cost neutral, we learned a lot about how to build a program like this and the potential groups of patients that may benefit. We're hoping that with the five-site demonstration project, we'll have, you know, a larger sample and we'll learn even more. I don't think we've found the right model exactly at this time, but I think that we've, you know, kind of found some potential opportunities to help these high-risk patients. And, it's a very tough problem. That's become very clear, and I don't think that there's going to be a very simple and fast solution. So my hope is that there will be opportunities to continue doing work in this area for enough time that we can really understand, you know, what are the challenges and opportunities, and is there an opportunity to make a difference. So I can tell you that in this iteration, there's a lot of interest in, of course, we would like to see changes in the cost curve and changes in some of the acute care utilization, but there's also a lot of interest in understanding the effects on patient experience and outcomes in other ways, and so hopefully we'll learn more around those topics, too.
That sounds great, and if I may editorialize just a second, when we're talking about program adoption and evaluating program adoption, it probably shouldn't be any less rigorous than defining whether we adopt or approve a new drug. And in the FDA world, you need multiple studies to show that the drug is safe and efficacious before it will be adopted and approved by FDA. So, and in many cases, there are multiple trials done and have conflicting results, and the FDA and the special panels that review those data have to make determination. So I think that this is a great pilot study, but it's clearly a pilot. I think it's going to be very important to see the additional studies that come out of this. On the flip side, getting back to your original sort of premise, Donna and Christine, this 5% of the population consumes 50%, half of all VA spending each year. And so it's a really critical component that we really need to figure out how to manage and do a better job with that. So I just wanted to thank you both for a great presentation. We're at the top of the hour, and I wanted to thank all the listeners out there, especially all those that asked questions. Would you guys like to say any closing remarks?
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to present today, and we're both happy to take additional questions if you want to email us. Our information's at the bottom there.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks, Christine. Thanks, Heidi.
Yes, thank you, Heidi. Bye.
Yes, thank you. For the audience, when I close the session out, you will be prompted with a feedback form. Please take a few moments to fill that out. We really do read through all of your feedback. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session. Thank you.
Thanks.